Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme is corruption and illegal activities targeting minorities in the New York Police Department. Today, we have a panel. Including in this panel will be Steve Ming. He is an Emmy-nominated documentarian and visual journalist in New York City. His first film, High Tech, Low Life, chronicled two of China's first dissident citizen journalists reporting on censored news throughout mainland China and was part of PBS's award-winning series, POV. Steve has directed films for The New York Times, Time Magazine, and The Nation, among others. He is a fellow of the Sundance Institute's documentary film program and an adjunct teacher at Massachusetts College of Art. His most recent feature, Crime and Punishment, now showing at the IFC Theater at 6th Avenue and 3rd Street through this Thursday, tells the gripping story of a landmark class action lawsuit spearheaded by a brave group of black and Latino cops turned whistleblower to expose an NYPD illegal quota system, especially targeting minorities. The film's website is crimeandpunishmentdoc.com. Joining us today will also be Sergeant Edwin Raymond, and he's been with the NYPD for 10 years, and he's a lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit featured in the documentary. Also, Pedro Serrano. He is a police officer with the New York Police Department and another lead plaintiff in the case. Joining us in a little while will be Sergeant Cyrus Smith. 19 years in the New York City's Performance Monitoring Unit. That's the department responsible for overseeing individual police departments, such as the NYPD, comply with departmental regulations as well as ticketing quotas. Sergeant Smith was a lead whistleblower for exposing how corruption was instituted at the NYPD's highest level. Nice to have you all with us today.
Thanks, Gary.
Hi, Steve, we're going to begin with you.
Sure.
I remember it was 35 years ago. I was sitting in a car over on First Avenue waiting for a friend who had just gone into a store to purchase something, and he had put money in the meter. And I was sitting on the in front seat, and I was reclining back, and I'm looking out the window, and I'm seeing this police officer ticketing every single car behind me. And then he came up and he didn't see me and he began to ticket this one. So I rolled down the window and I said, "Officer," I said, "look at the meter. This is not out of time." And he just looked at me and shrugged his shoulders, went ahead and did the ticket, stuck it in the window. So at that time we didn't have cell phones. We couldn't snap a picture of all this. But my friend, you know, went downtown and beat the ticket. And until you're actually a victim of a crime, you frequently don't realize how pervasive that crime is. So the fact that people can commit crimes frequently with impunity, if there is a unwritten rule that it's okay to do this. Now, at that time, it wasn't just minorities. It was they had to give tickets, they would give tickets. I've also had a lot of friends. I'm talking about a lot of friends. In fact, there were at least 12 New York City police officers and detectives that used to go jogging all together every week in Central Park. They were part of the Natural Living and Running Walking Club. And the stories they would tell were concerning. And part of the stories they would tell, and these were Caucasians, African Americans, Latinos, they would tell stories such as this, that no, I wouldn't do that, but I didn't talk against the people who did. There's kind of like this unwritten rule that you protect those who are with you, and there's a blue wall. And I thought, but if you know that someone's doing something that's not right, you get them aside and have a private conversation with them. And the answer is no. That rarely is the case. You just go ahead and do what you have to do. And I said, but that means then that sooner or later, it becomes very pervasive. Now the question is, are we at that point where there is an unwritten rule that people in the police department can ticket people, especially people of color, with impunity. And start there and tell us the story, please.
Sure. I think the idea behind what you described is essentially this kind of notion of the banality of evil, right? That things seems so mundane in a sense that it goes by unnoticed for years and years. And that's the situation we have been seeing with the NYPD and its use of quotas by way of the justification through the larger broken windows theory policing that William Bratton instituted in New York City. The way we got involved was basically looking at the stop and frisk issue in New York City and in the buildup to the Floyd versus City of New York federal trial. We had been in touch with a few anonymous officers in the department who were actually part of the trial. Turns out to be Adil Polanco and Peter Serrano. And when things after the trial ruling didn't actually seem to be improving as everybody thought, but with even the new de Blasio administration and his appointment of William Bratton for a second term, cops on the ground and CUNY members were expressing to us that they felt things were actually getting worse. My producing partner, Ross Tuttle, and I set out to basically do what was going to be our fourth project on quotas. This time, looking far beyond stop and frisk. And everybody thought the sort of ruling on stop and frisk would fix this problem, and it absolutely did not. Even though the numbers went down dramatically, the kind of corruption that can occur in the most minuscule and most traumatic ways for community members, particularly the most vulnerable, those in minority communities, was being diverted to other kinds of what cops call pretextual stops. So situations where you could stop somebody for some sort of seeming probable cause and then instigate perhaps a search or run an ID for possible warrants, things like this. And so what we set out to do was basically look at this kind of cycle of trauma that was occurring both in the communities and also for cops who were sort of being most pressured to meet the quota each month.
At the end of the day, who is behind the pressure from above to get these quotas? And how much money are we talking about this being taken from innocent citizens? And let's face it, many of the minorities in New York City are the least able to pay a fine and therefore a greater financial burden to them.
Well, I'll touch on the second part of your question and then I'll toss it to my co-panelists here. The city we know is pulling in tens of millions in revenue, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. The film, cites a few figures. One is this idea that between 2007 and 2015, over 900,000 criminal summonses were overturned because of a lack of probable cause. 900,000, and you have to consider that each of those criminal summonses were attached to an officer benefiting, meaning by getting closer to the monthly quota, and also for those, that 900,000 summonses where individuals pled guilty, that's straight revenue into the city's coffers. In addition to that, traffic agents, which fall under the purview of as NYPD employees, are pulling over in roughly $545 million annually in revenue. And then you look at criminal summonsing that pours through the courts. That's easily $20 to $30 million a year in criminal summonses that, for those who, plead guilty, are exposed to a whole menu of possible arrest-related fees that, in the form of administrative court fees, bail. There's even, outside of these kinds of court expenses, exposure to asset forfeitures if you do plead guilty to sort of expedite your release from jail, as we saw in the case of Pedro Hernandez, which we followed over the course of his placement in Rikers for 12 months, ultimately for the judge not to even apologize, but just, you know, when the DA said, turns out we don't have enough evidence. And in fact, our evidence is conflicting, the little evidence we have, so we're going to withdraw the charges. You know, there was no apology by the system. There was no reparations for that traumatic year in Rikers. And so, you know, more than the actual fiscal impact, we're looking at a psychic and even physical harm that's being implemented against the communities of color. And if it happens even once, you know, that's absolutely unacceptable. But, it, you know, we know that it's happening on a magnitude that the public and the city thus far has been unwilling to come to terms with. The other part of your question, I think you might want to hear from some of the other officers.
I appreciate your answer, Steve. Thank you. To the other officers, I'm going to paint with a little broader brush now. Examine my concerns, and wherever you feel confident and comfortable that you could add something, then we'll jump in with the next person, Sergeant Edwin Raymond. And here are some of the pieces of the puzzle that I've been working on, that we've been writing about and broadcasting on for some time. And it's personal to me because I have my family. My father was police officer. My godfather was chief of police. I have a lot of police in my family and a lot of friends. And I can remember growing up as a baby boomer in a small community in West Virginia where the police were there to protect and serve. And people respected the police. You never heard someone being against the police. It just because the police were always there as arbiters also. There was always some verbal arbitration. What's the problem? What's the solution? And I never will forget once my godfather, Russ Mowry, said to me, I don't arrest most people because I have to know that that person is going to be shamed by that in this small community, and I don't want them being shamed by people because that shame is going to spread to their wife or brothers, sisters, and their kids. So if I can resolve an issue, and I saw him do this, you know, where he would say, you did this, you got drunk, you're going to go over this weekend and you're going to fix the plumbing in the First Christian Church. The guy was a plumber, but he got drunk. And as a result, it was a different mindset. Now, I grew up that way, and a lot of my friends in the police department are that way today. Now, here's what we're faced with. Here's the bigger picture. Asset forfeitures. We never heard of asset forfeitures until about 10 years ago. They just didn't exist unless it was a organized crime or drug dealing, in which case they would confiscate the person's ill-gotten gains. But today we're talking about $4.3 billion, with a B, billion dollars, where assets were seized but no tickets were even given. There was not even a pretense the person had committed a crime. Over 10,000 cars were taken. And also in one state, in Oklahoma, again, this has nothing to do with New York, but in Oklahoma, they actually brought in a machine 2 years ago that they would ask for all your credit cards and put all your credit cards in this machine, would draw all the money right out of your bank account. Now, then you could go fight it. Well, good luck on that. And a lot of people just, it's not worth it if the money was not that big. And in other cases, it was large, and people did fight, and frequently when they fought, they could frequently win. So asset forfeiture is a big deal. The militarization of the police. When you look outside today and you see many police dressed as if they're in combat uniforms, that scares the hell out of people because it doesn't look like anyone wants to talk, and that as quick as you can think, they're going to react. And we don't like the idea of militarization of police. Also, the idea of searching and seizing, where you suddenly take a kid that might have a small amount of marijuana on them, and then they're arrested when they show it to the police officer, and they could spend years in prison and their life destroyed. And yet three presidents, George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama, acknowledged in their memoirs that they used drugs, and a lot of them. So you would think that they would be against these sentencing structures and these arrest structures. Well, just the opposite. Clinton doubled down and put an awful lot of people in prison, over 2.5 million. And so we're concerned that today drugs are no better than prohibition, and as prohibition gave us all the organized crime, Lucky Luciano and that whole group, today you have cartels that are bloody, murderous, all over Central and South America and Mexico. And when are we going to stop and just use common sense and say, what the hell are we doing arresting someone because they're using or possess some marijuana? And then you have the last part of it, and that is debtors' prisons. There were 88,000 SWAT raids last year, and not because there was a hostage situation, which would justify it, or some serious situation, but mainly to serve notices and to arrest people for delinquent crimes. Now, debtors' prisons was erased in the 1833. We have debtors' prisons today. Poor people are going to jail, and a lot of people who are arrested don't have the money to make bail. So they go into that gulag of Rikers Island, and then they're exposed to all that element within inside of that system. And the latest project shows that up to 40% of people arrested in the United States were not guilty. So I'm concerned that the police are getting a bad rap. Is it deserved or not, in part or whole? And what can be done about it? So we're going to start with you, Sergeant Edward Raymond. Take your time, select the area that you feel comfortable and confident discussing, and share your thoughts with our audience.
Okay, first and foremost, thanks for having us, Gary. Appreciate the opportunity to speak these truths. So regarding your questions and statements, what I got from it is one thing that causes that confusion that many Americans have in terms of how they perceive the police or how they remember the police and what they're seeing now and how their perceptions are now is race in America. It's probably the biggest part of the equation. So most white Americans don't feel there's much wrong with policing in America today. And those experiences that you've had where officers were able to use discretion, they'd grown up in Virginia. I've literally watched the most callous supervisor who never uses discretion all of a sudden have a very human, just a very caring personality when the rare instances that a young white person would be arrested for something that we arrest black and Hispanic people of color for every day, and no one even glances. And all of a sudden, I see this completely different person, and I realize that it's race in America. There's the perception that African Americans, certain people of color, demographic, are problems. People with who are criminals, implicit biases. It just doesn't allow for that human connection. Because if we have a connection on a human level first, this is where you can have that discretion and other ways of policing. And, as a black man, I find it quite confusing and strange when I'd be standing in Times Square and a white family would walk by and say, "Thank you for your service." I never even knew people said these things to cops. Because where I'm from, in the inner cities of Brooklyn, cops weren't seen as people who we thank for service. We didn't even see it as a service. We saw it more as an occupying force. So I believe the perception and the experiences in white America when it comes to police are just very different from the experiences that certain people of color have with police. Now, going back to discretion, enforcement quotas take away discretion. Because when you have a quota to meet, when you have a number to meet in terms of in amount of summonses, arrests, stop and frisk, if you have that human connection, which leads to discretion, you're not going to meet those numbers. So as an officer, you have to be a lot more stern and a lot more callous in how you enforce. And so this is why, for instance, arrests for marijuana, which is what I refer to as the lowest hanging fruit. This is why it's sky high in New York. And you'll see all this legislation and policy change trying to bring the numbers down, when in reality, all they have to do is get rid of enforcement quotas. Because you give officers in quotas, they're gonna fill them. And the easiest thing to do is anything dealing with substances. So it's no coincidence, up until about 2 years ago, that the number one reason that people are arrested in New York City is for marijuana. And the number one reason that people are summoned is for public consumption of alcohol. Both substances, where Department of Health statistics show white Americans use, if not at the same level as black and Hispanics, actually slightly more, depending on which studies you read. And yet, over 80% of those arrested and summoned are people of color. So you ask, when will this stop, or when can this change? How can this change? I mean, this is what we're trying to do, and you know, those of us known as the NYPD 12. But if you study history, you'll see resources get applied to help situations when enough white Americans are negatively affected, and you see this happening year by year with the heroin opiate crisis here in New York and throughout the nation. You know, 20 years, 25 years ago, when it was crack cocaine ravaging the inner city, you know, we so-called arrested our way out of the problem. Many people, it was seen as a crime, but today, you know, opiate use is seen as health crisis, because when it affects white America, again, the human face to the problem is there. But sadly, people of color, you know, due to the history of this nation, are not given that same courtesy, that same compassion. So that's my answer for everything.
Have you ever? And the money. I'd like a follow up, please.
Sure.
In giving tickets to people who did not deserve it, does that ever come back on you as guilt or self shame?
Well, me personally, I didn't engage in that practice, which is why my career has been a lot of retaliation. I've been dealing with a lot of pushback and retaliation. But I've spoken to colleagues who have done that. And yeah, many times they don't feel good about it. And the thing is, they'll rationalize. Because the thing is, you don't have to give it to someone who doesn't deserve it, as long as they're technically in violation. And that's the rationalization. The reality is, it's the pettiest of offenses, the most innocuous. But as long as the technicality is there, that the law was broken, you spit on the ground. Technically, you're not allowed to spit on the ground in New York. Now, are you really going to summon someone for that, is the question. So technically, many officers will never see it as giving a summons to someone who didn't deserve it, as long as they have the probable cause. But when you throw in ethics and morality, and not just the legality of it, that's where the focus needs to be. And even there absolutely is guilt. Many colleagues I've spoken to, they say, you know, I hated the fact that I had to do this, but you know, I'm going on vacation next month. Sorry, that's five less days to meet the quota. So I have to get this out of the way. I have to get the quota out of the way.
I appreciate that. Final question for you at this time. What has been the retaliation within the department and by other officers that you might have gone to the academy with or befriended? How have they responded to your stepping out and telling the truth?
Okay. So with the department, the retaliation started before going public. In terms of retaliatory assignments, lowered evaluations, taking away opportunities to earn overtime, denial of days off, and just things to really just make your life miserable, because you spend a lot of hours at work, arguably more hours than you do with your family, and it just gives, you know, you don't want to be miserable those hours, and they know what can make you miserable, and they continue to do that. So after going public, shortly after going public, I became a supervisor, and that has actually helped to protect me from a lot of the things that I would have been a victim of had I not been promoted. Because in the NYPD, once you're promoted to supervisor, there are certain responsibilities and duties that you'll pretty much never really do. You'll never have to do, because that's the duties of subordinates. So that is added a layer of protection. But, you know, in the film, it shows that my own subordinates actually galvanized and tried, that they triggered an investigation against me for engaging in what's known, what they refer to as reverse racism, that, you know, that I let someone go simply because they were a black person, and basically I let my politics, because that's how they misunderstand what my stance is. So basically I let my politics cause me to not do my job properly. So that's one thing. In not being promoted in time, my promotion was held up for 9 months. When it was time to be promoted again to lieutenant, I was missing the time and rank needed. You need a minimum of 2 years in rank as sergeant to be promoted to lieutenant. And I should have been promoted 2 months ago, 3 months ago. But instead, you know, I'll have to wait because I was wrongfully held up for sergeant. So that's a continuation of the original retaliation. So that's what I personally experienced. And in terms of the officers that I went to the academy with and that are in my precinct, many of them, they don't speak to me anymore. They refuse to speak to me. Behind my back, they call me a rat. And, you know, my reputation with them is shot.
Well, have you ever thought of this way? Why would you care what they think of you if they're doing what you would not do out of conscience and what you wouldn't do out of morality and proper justice?
Absolutely.
Yeah, why do you need them as friends?
I agree. The thing with my job that makes it dangerous, though, is, you know, I might be in a situation where I have to call for backup. And, you know, it's sadly one of the things that can happen is they don't respond or they take their time getting there. So this is why, in terms of caring, I'm not here to lose friends, but if I have to, it is what it is. But with this type of work, It can be dangerous.
Okay. You've been listening to Sergeant Edwin Raymond. He has been a 10-year veteran of a sergeant at the police department, and he is a part of a class action lawsuit. He is also part of the documentary Crime and Punishment, now screening at the IFC Theater at 6th Avenue and 30th Street through this Thursday. And you can go online if you can't get to it, and crimeandpunishmentdoc.com. Let's now bring into our discussion Pedro Serrano, also a police officer and another lead plaintiff in the case. Nice to have you with us today, Pedro.
Thank you for having me.
Pedro, I'm not going to ask you different questions because I put so many different components that you're free to address. So take your time, please, and tell us your story, because no one comes out of the closet of anything in life as a whistleblower, as anything else, and even as a social activist or citizen journalist, unless you've reached a point where you can no longer tolerate something. It's like a divorce. By the time someone says this is over, oh, it's been over for a long time. It's just having the courage and circumstance to say it's over. So I'd like to know, what precipitated you coming to that moment where you said, no matter what the consequences to me or my family, I've got to do what my conscience dictates? Take it from there, please.
Well, it happened over time. When I say this all the time, when I went to the police academy, I really wanted to do good things for the civilians and, you know, just people in general. And when I went to the academy, they taught me the correct way. You listen to all the teachings, and they tell you how to do things the right way. You graduate, and the first day you go to the precinct. They tell you, throw everything out the window that you learned. That's books. This is real life. And this is how we do it. And it's a culture. And they teach you from day one that The rules are different. And if you don't follow their rules, you could lose your life, you could lose your job, and you would make it a very miserable 20 years. And they'll tell you right off the bat. I didn't know this right off the bat, but little by little, year by year, I started to see things that were just wrong. And I tried to just go my way. And like you said before, just don't bother. Just go somewhere else and let them do what they got to do. But eventually it catches up to you and it corners you. And then they force you to do things you don't want to do. Arrests that are just not, they don't make sense to you. And the police department, the way I describe it, one word to describe them is abuse. Everything that they touch, they abuse it. They abused stop and frisk, arrests, summonses, internal affairs, monitoring, trespass, how they discipline minorities. I mean, all of that. The system there seems like a good system, but then they get their hands on it and they make it into a numbers game, and then it gets personal and they go after people of color. And they do that both in the community and in the police department. So over time, I started to see these things happen. And then we started to meet after work, people in precincts, in different precincts. We used to meet in diners and just talk about things. And we brought it to our PBA, and the PBA just laughed at us. We actually gave them sworn statements that were notarized, and we made complaints. And they took those papers and just said, yeah, we'll take care of it. Nothing ever happened. What happened was it got back to the commanding officer, and then the commanding officer just did whatever he wanted to. But one of the questions you said also was, where does all this start from? It starts at the top, where all what we call the super chiefs. They're the ones that have most of the power, and they're at the top, and they control everything. So you got the mayor and the police commissioner. They'll tell the public that stop and frisk is not happening, we're not targeting black people, et cetera. They just keep, you know, saying whatever has to be said, but it doesn't trickle down to the commander at the precinct. So the commander of the precinct gets to do whatever he wants and enforce whatever he wants, however he wants to. And he's basically a czar. And anybody who goes against him, you're committing suicide in regards to your career. So they'll tell you one thing, it's happening, and then when it gets to the commanding officer, it's all about the numbers. They know that last year, at this date, they had this many summonses, this many arrests, and this many stop and frisk. They need to match those numbers, or they're going to hear it when they get to CompStat. Now, again, CompStat is a great tool. So is stop and frisk. But when soon as you get in, soon as you put it into the hands of the police department, they abuse it, and they make it into a numbers game, and then they go after the people who are not going to defend themselves. Like you said, they can't afford lawyers. They go after black and brown. They go after people in poor neighborhoods, and eventually they plea because they tell them you can go to jail. You could go to jail for 5 years, or you could plea to an ACD, and you could leave now. Just plead guilty to whatever they say, you know, a discon, so you can't sue later on. So there's so much. There's so much corruption, abuse, and greed, and within the police department that it's just so hard where to start. I mean, my thing is put a panel somewhere outside the police department, because the police cannot police themselves. It's impossible. So you get a panel somewhere. If there's some issues, then we go out there and we get real-time decisions, not 5 years later. Not 2 years later. I mean, if there's a situation where black people are being targeted, then let's address it. Let's show the proof, and then you have to hold people accountable. No one's held accountable. All these super chiefs and anybody above the rank of, I guess, lieutenant or captain, if something goes wrong, they're allowed to retire, and with retire, and then you could do whatever you have to do in court. If you're a police officer, they won't let you retire. They hold you until it's taken care of. And in the meantime, they just destroy your career. And then now you're on probation, and anything you do, and I'm talking about anything, they could fire you because they feel like it. So unfortunately, the corruption starts from the top, the abuse starts from the top, and the only way that I see it ending is having a chance for us to, you know, have our day in court, is to have a panel, a federal oversight, where we can go and plead our case and then hold people accountable. Because when you hold someone accountable, now they're worried about it. But right now, they could do whatever they want. As soon as they get – look at all these chiefs that were
the sex scandal, there was the pay-to-play
scandal. Right, in the plane, and then the license with the guns.
Yeah.
They were all allowed to retire.
Yeah, at and full
then,
pension.
Good.
No, they retired at full pension, but it was they did not retire or were forced out because of anything you're discussing. That's the problem. It's just the pay-to-play, what they accepted in bribes to put people into different positions or do favors for people. And look at what they could have been held accountable for, that what all of you are saying, and not a word of any of this was ever in any of the media.
Exactly. And they're protected. So they're allowed to retire with their pension, and no one's held accountable. So basically the rule is get to the top, do whatever it takes to get to the top. When you're there, you have immunity. We call it white shirt immunity. And then if something happens, we'll let you retire, and you can handle it on your own. But you still have your pension. So unfortunately, there's just so many issues that need to be taken care of that it's just a very tough situation. And without somewhere we can go, but they're even saying that we can't even fight against quotas. It's ridiculous. And they make their own rules. When I recorded a supervisor, shortly after that, they put it in their patrol guide that we can't record them. And if we do, we have to follow a procedure. So if I'm a police officer and I witness corruption, I can't do things about it. And if I do, I have to let them know. And if I let them know, they come after me. So no matter what we do to fight them, they just create another law, another rule, and that's how they fix it. That's how they keep
Pedro,
all information. Go ahead.
Pedro, where is the union that's supposed to be there protecting you? What role do they play in this?
Well, personally, this is just how I feel. The union is a machine. So is the police department. They're two champions, if you want to say, two of the big monsters. We could only fight one, in my opinion, one person at a time or one machine at a time. To sit there and blame everything in the union would only have them come after us. So all I can say about the union is that they haven't done anything for us. And a couple of times they've actually done certain things against us. So all I got to say about the union is I have no comment for now. You know, it's only because they're like two mafias. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but going up against two of the biggest machines out there, it's a daunting task.
I appreciate your input, Pedro. We'll come back for final statements, but we want to be joined now by Sergeant Cyrus Smith. And Cyrus spent over 14 years in New York City Performance Monitoring Unit. That's the department responsible for overseeing individual police departments, such as the NYPD, different stations, and that they are complying with departmental regulations as well as ticketing quotas. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, how are you doing? Actually, I've been on the job for over 21 years, and I'm still active.
Oh, wow. Okay, thank you. I don't know if you heard from the beginning, but I opened it up with a broad look. And going into the final 15 minutes of our program, or the last 10 minutes of our program, I want to go back to certain issues that are on people's minds. For example, and especially people of color, and we have a lot of people of color listening to this program, just over one of our stations alone, WBAI in New York. And that is when a person of color, Latino or Black, Indian, or even Native American, when they are stopped, they feel helpless. They feel oppressed, and especially those who have done nothing wrong. We're not talking about people committing crimes where there's a high probable cause that a person is armed, dangerous, or committing a crime. We're talking about where a person has really not done anything, and yet they're going to be a part of that quota system. You do not see people going down to Wall Street or the theater district as people are going in or out of Broadway plays and ticketing them. That just never happens. You never see the top executives of any of the major Fortune 500 companies downtown being ticketed or being stopped. There's clearly a bias here, and it's palpable. And so people feel helpless. They feel that the machine, as Pedro was just talking about, the machine is so big and omnipresent. It's everywhere. That how do you fight it? That's number one. Number two is the whole idea that now the private prison system is exploiting this, getting legislation where a certain number of beds have to be filled every year for them to make a profit, and so therefore there's a greater incentive to pass rules at the state level to get more people who otherwise wouldn't have fallen into any problem with a criminal conviction now to be criminalized for it. And thirdly, the fact that the police are militarized now, and that scares them, because then it's like we against them. And my final thought is there are hundreds of thousands of police officers in the United States. So when we see something that is so over the top, so egregious, so clearly wrong, why is it that most of those cases where a police officer has killed a person, including the one out in Arizona where the man was on his hands and knees with his hands up and he was shot to death, or the one out in New Mexico where there was a homeless man who was in the woods and all these armed to the gills guys with to a harmless man, and they just shot him to death. In fact, they have the highest rate per population of shooting people out there in New Mexico, and yet they seem time and again to get away with it. Now, from a police officer's perspective, how do so many police not be held accountable for what is clearly an injustice being perpetrated? Address any of those that you feel comfortable addressing, please.
Sure. Let me start by saying that if the problem of quotas or any type of oppression of people of color, if these issues are going to be adequately addressed, you got to start by changing the culture of the New York City Police Department, okay, which is a culture built on bias, racism, sexism, any type of ism you can think of, all right, and the training ground for what you see is happening to minority communities, the training ground is within the police department. What I mean by that is, has anybody stopped to think and reflect, really, even before this film, about what Black people, Hispanic people, people of color are experiencing on a daily basis with inside the NYPD? The episodes of trumped-up charges, okay, a corrupt disciplinary system, okay? And we can't even go and plead to our unions. But we're left at the mercies of abusive, racist supervisors who can decide willy-nilly what to do to transfer us, to beat us down, to take vacation days away, to deny us days off, to take away overtime. All this power and with no oversight. So if something's going to be done about that, it has to be addressed inside. And I'm talking about comprehensively. I'm not talking about do some type of community policing program. Because let me tell you something, the police department is like a pot of soil, okay? On the top of that soil, you have that good topsoil that the flowers grow, you know, the plants grow, and it looks pretty, the dark, rich-looking soil. But as you dig down, you start to get into that rocky, grainy soil, sandy soil, which nothing can grow in. That's the culture of the police department. And that's the training ground. What a lot of what you see is perpetrated against the community of colors right now. That's the culture that I'm working in, that the NYPD 12 is working in. That's the culture that we're fighting. And if you're going to see any kind of change, any kind of substantive change, you have to go within that cancer and do something about it. Because otherwise, it's going to be like a merry-go-round. and it's not going to stop. And so that, and then other things you brought up, like the prison system, the military, police, New Mexico, that's all about a culture. That's all about the you know, how people of color are dealt with in the larger society in general. You know, and unless you, unless you attack that, nothing's going to happen. So I've, for years, I've been a part of what, in NYPD, what you call a performance monitoring program. And so police officers who have been accused of not performing or not meeting quotas or who have been involved in off-duty, on-duty incidences, whether innocent or guilty, they're placed in this program. It was my job to monitor them. So I began to see over a certain period of time, you know, certain patterns or police officers coming to me, describing to me how they are unfairly disciplined or unfairly placed in the performance monitoring program. And I had to say something. I had to say something, not only because it happened to me in such a blatant racist way where I was transferred because I said something about the evaluation system, that I said something about the performance monitoring system. You know, but this, again, this is the type of culture, this is the type of discipline system that people of color, not just people of color, I will tell you that white people are affected by it too, but any oppressive system, whether slavery, Jim Crow, mass incarceration, you always have white people have caught up into it too, but not in the great numbers that you see people of color. So you got to affect change through the culture of the New York City Police Department. And this has been going on for years before I was a thought in my mother's mind. You know, the New York Police Department has been a brutal entity.
Sergeant Smith, a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, was an ADA, Assistant District Attorney. His name's Elliot. And one day at dinner, he said, "I got to quit." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because the system is so corrupt." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "There are so many people going to jail who shouldn't be there, and their people cannot defend themselves. They're too poor." And so I said, "Well, then quit. Go on the other side." And that's exactly what he did. He went over and became a public defender. And even there, he said that the system is the system. And he said, no politician's going to correct the system because they don't want to alienate the union, which represents tens of thousands of votes. And when you ask, when you look at a police officer plus their wives and other members of their family who are generally close-knit, you might be talking about 100,000 potential votes, and so no one's going to go against them. And he said that he saw on both sides. For years he was assistant district attorney, then for years he was a public defender, and he said it's 99% likely that when someone's arrested, if they're a person of color, they're going to be treated with prejudice, with malice aforethought, and the assumption is that they have no place to go because they don't have the money to get out of the system. He said he would frequently have 100 cases. He would maybe have minutes before a person went into the jury or into the judge to find out about the person, and he'd be finding out about it there when he's in front of the judge. That's no time to prepare. Your thoughts?
If I told you the same thing happens within the NYPD trial room, what would you say about that? If I tell you that minority cops are treated the same way when it comes to disciplinary issues, would you believe me? Well, I'm telling you that. And again, this is a training ground for a lot that happens in the public. For example, I could be accused of something. I could be accused of a disciplinary infraction. I could be completely innocent, okay? And there's no evidence against me to substantiate that charge within the NYPD trial room. But because I'm a person of color and because I don't know anybody, because I don't wear a white shirt, okay, I'm forced to cop a deal where I will lose vacation days, if more vacation days, where I'll be disciplined more harshly if I do not accept what they were offering me. It's the same exact thing that we see out in the public, and the same exact phenomenon is being that was displayed in this film by Stephen Mann, Crime and Punishment. I keep on drawing this distinction, this line, that if you're going to stop that, if you're going to stop that inequity, you know, that injustice is happening in the criminal courts, you know, you have to go go to the culture of the New York City Police Department and see what's happening there. So that's why I'm so glad that there's some sort of commission that's going to investigate the disciplinary system. And then it's my understanding that the people who are going to head this endeavor, you know, is some very reputable people. I'm just concerned that it's not going to dig further. It's not going to dig deep enough to reveal the actual players that's involved in this injustice within the NYPD trial room. And it's going to be very deep, and it's nothing less than corruption.
Well, Sergeant Cyrus Smith and Police Officer Pedro Serrano and Sergeant Edwin Raymond, and the producer of this and director of this program is Steve Meng. We will provide all of our journalists and citizen investigative journalists from WBAI on this issue, so you'll have a forum as this evolves to come on and discuss it. We have a large audience, the largest progressive audience in the world, so at least you have friends on this side of the issue. I'm saddened by what I hear, but I also want to tell you you're all heroes because you stood up, you walked out against a mammoth machine that could tear a person's reputation right out of them, destroy their livelihood. And to do that, that takes courage. And one thing all Americans acknowledge, it doesn't matter what their color, ethnicity, or background, we acknowledge courage as a country. So in our books, you're all people of courage. Thank you for being with us today. And please, everyone, watch Crime and Punishment, now screening at the IFC at 6th Avenue and 3rd Street. If you can't, then go to the website crimeandpunishmentdoc.com. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for watching and have a good day.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I dig it.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality.
Sister,
talk to me,
sister,
so you can see,
sister,
oh, what's going on,
what's going on,
what's going on,
what's going on,
yeah, what's going on,
what's going
on, oh, what's going on,
what's going on,
oh,
right now, right now.
Oh, but who would they judge us simply 'cause our